welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 19th of April 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. It's the beginning of another week and that means we are here today to discuss the weekend's news and all the interesting things that are happening in Britain, and that means that we have with us today Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? It's a beautiful day here. What's it like where you are?
It's a beautiful day here as well. I think the whole weekend has been good weather by and large, isn't it? There's been plenty of sunshine and I think people are starting to get out and visiting each other again, and that's all to the good in my view.
Yeah, it's great to see. Pubs have been open. People have been able to get back there. Apparently lots of people have been out shopping, and on Saturday it was a beautiful, glorious day without a cloud in the sky, which was absolutely perfect for Prince Philip's funeral. I was lucky enough to actually be able to sit here and watch all of it. It was wonderful to see. It really was to see the army there in dressed up in their royal military regalia, and to see the Air Force there in their royal regalia, and the Navy were there in their royal regalia. And then we had the royal family who weren't in their royal military regalia because Prince Harry is not allowed to wear it. And they decided rather than make Prince Harry feel the odd one out, they would all just wear their civilian clothes, which was a great shame, really. And I would hope that Prince Harry felt a lot of shame in causing his family to do that, but he's so thick-skinned, I doubt whether he really realised just how bad that looked. But apart from that, it was fantastic. The music was amazing, really moving. Watching them marching to their place within the palace was great. They were not putting a foot wrong, all moving in unison. Watching the pallbearers, the coffin bearers, how they actually manoeuvred this coffin around. It's quite incredible to see. They have like a cloth that hangs over it, and that was apparently not the coat of arms, but some other kind of heraldry to do with Prince Philip. And they were manoeuvring this coffin around underneath the cloth, and it looked like it was levitating. I couldn't work out quite how they were doing it. Yeah, how they were getting it onto their shoulders. I mean, maybe I'm not. I haven't been to too many funerals. I guess they have to do that at every one. But yeah, it was really, really good. And seeing Prince George's Chapel, I mean, it's an absolutely beautiful church that they have there. Amazing stained glass windows, lots of sculpture, really glorious. And apparently that is really the central church of the whole country, that is in honour of St. George, our patron saint. I very, very patriotic, felt very proud to be British actually looking at this funeral. And it just seemed as if the whole country had was in silence for the 2 minute silence, 1 minute silence as well. And they were shooting cannons off as well. And before that, I was actually looking at the heraldry for Prince Philip, and his coat of arms, it has what is supposed to be, it looked to me like the Kern Abbas giant. It was supposedly an early Briton with ivy, an ivy wreath on his head, and holding a club with a lion belt around him, like a sort of kilt. And of course, the holding the club is reminiscent of the Kern Abbas giant, which is carved into the Dorset hillside, and it's a little bit of a lewd image as well. And apparently this heraldry was gifted to Prince Philip by King George when he was marrying Queen Elizabeth. And I just couldn't help but wonder whether they had a chuckle over that and the similarity of it to the Kern Abbas giant, and quite what he was intending to infer by that. And of course, there is also links to Hercules as well. And I just thought, what a fantastic piece of heraldry for such an alpha male. And he had his Land Rover, of course, which was specially designed for this funeral, which he designed himself. It was all green, and you could hear the sound of the Land Rover that, of course, people are going to recognise. And they also had his carriage there and his horses from his carriage racing, and they had his cap there. Apparently, the bowl that he used to have sugar lumps in, that he used to feed the horses with, and just watching it, it just made me think this is something that's gone on for centuries. All this pomp and pageantry, and it's still exactly the same today as it was centuries ago. And it really provides a link with the early years of our past as a nation and as a country. And I think it's something we could be very, very proud of. And I'm not very often very proud of the royal family, but I think this funeral yesterday was something to be proud of. And it was a shame that we couldn't have lots of people there. And I guess that really shows that the Queen is just as under the thumb as everybody else, really. She looked really upset. I mean, she had her head bowed with her black hat on, and you couldn't see her face, and she was just sat there all on her own, just this tiny figure. She couldn't have anybody around her because of these COVID regulations. And I mean, she is the Queen, and we say, well, she has to give her assent to every law. But really, I mean, if she was to fight back, the same sort of thing is going to happen to her as happened to the Tsar of Russia, and that happened to King Charles when Cromwell chopped his head off. You know, I don't think the royals can really provide any resistance today, unfortunately. So it was sad to see that she was there on her own. The choir singing was amazing, just four choir boys, and you can imagine what it would be like if that space was filled up with a full choir. I mean, it would really be raising the roof off. The architecture of St. George's Chapel, that's incredible on the inside. It's just like a forest, but all made out of stone. The archways and the columns that are going up there, and the castle itself is a beautiful castle. Apparently there were lots of people outside that wanted to pay their respects, and that there was one crazy socialist left-wing topless woman that tried to create a spectacle, but she was moved away pretty quickly. It was good to see the beefeaters with their big hats, and to see all the military with their heads bowed as well, and making a point of having them bowed as they were lined up on this green, this almost like a pavilion, I guess, the quadrangle, I think they called it, as they were outside playing the music. Just, incredible, very moving. And I really enjoyed watching it. I give this description because I know that you were only able to actually hear it as it was going on, Max, on the radio. But what were your thoughts on the funeral yesterday then?
Yes, I thoroughly agree, actually, with everything that you said. I was only able to listen to it on the radio because I was traveling at the time. Firstly, what I would say is that with regard to the wearing of uniforms, I think there was a question over Prince Andrew and whether or not he would be able to wear a uniform as well. And so it wasn't just entirely Prince Harry, but I take your point that it was very sad that the full regalia wasn't able to be worn by everybody involved. I think that what yesterday proved is that even though it was a quiet affair, or a quieter affair than might otherwise have taken place because the Duke of Edinburgh wanted it that way, it proved once again that nobody does pageantry like the British. And I would imagine that there would have been heads of state from all over the world who would have been watching that on television, and who would have been sighing deeply regretting the fact that they can't do the same sort of thing in their country because they don't have the tradition. And as you say, the pageantry that takes place at these kind of events is something which has evolved over hundreds of years. I think it went into another gear with the Victorian period. There was a tremendous increase in the kind of display of pomp and circumstance on state occasions. But it is something that goes back to very early times, and something, as I say, that has been developed over centuries. And as I say, nobody does it like we do it. And that was proven yesterday.
Yeah, I think we should give credit to the BBC, funnily enough, and not for their programming, but for their filming. There was only one point when I spotted a boom for a camera. And that was it. Apparently, they actually had someone hiding inside a fake column that was actually filming the bits with the coffin. So the actual filming work was stupendous. I mean, that's quite a challenge to film all of that and not have any of the cameras be seen, and also manage to get all these close-ups of what was going on. And also, it was 99.9% white. When they were actually leading the coffin onto the Land Rover, there was a black guy that they put right at the very front. And that was the only black face that I spotted out of all of it, which I was very surprised at. They did have quite a few non-whites that they were interviewing at the time. John Sentamu, who was quite interesting. He always is. He's quite funny. But just actually among the military, it was all mainly whites. I would give that 10 out of 10, I guess. And it's really the only royal funeral that I can recall seeing. I don't know if Lady Di was actually buried there or whether she was at Westminster Abbey, because I think the main ones that they have are at Westminster Abbey. That seems to be the place that some of these greatest Britons have
Lady
been.
Lady Diana is buried in an island in her family's estate in Northamptonshire. There's an island in the middle of a lake in that estate, and she's buried on that island.
Oh, wow. Well, I didn't know that. But, all in all, as I say, I would definitely have given that 10 out of 10. That was very moving, and certainly a good tribute to, I think he was our greatest royal, certainly the greatest royal that I can remember in living memory. Obviously, there have been much, much better ones in the past, but as somebody to emulate and look up to and to set a good example for the nation, I don't think we could have asked for much better than Prince Philip. May he rest in peace. Max, you were telling me there was something else on to do with the BBC that you were listening to this week.
Well, it wasn't so much that I was listening to it this week. I noticed the advertisements for this series of programmes, and this is part of BBC Sounds, and I could see what was coming at the very moment that I saw the first trailer for it. And there are three podcasts that have already been shown for this, and there's a further five podcasts that are going to be shown for it. And this says possibly, you know, where the funeral yesterday was a high point for the BBC, I think that these podcasts are probably going to turn out to be a low point for the BBC, because what they're called is Brixton Flames on the Front Line, and it's a series that's being produced and presented by a chap called Big Nasty, whose real name I believe is Tyrone Lindo, who is a black rapper, and what's happening is that there is a retelling of the Brixton riots from effectively the rioters' point of view, from what I can see. And various people who were who took part in the riots are being asked to for their opinions with regard to, you know, what took place, etc. And it seems that in this year, or the last year, where we've had all the Black Lives Matter protesters last year, this series of podcasts seems almost as if the BBC are deliberately trying to propagandize what happened back in 1981 in order to mentally prepare the black community in this country for perhaps further similar protests and riots and things that might take place in this country later on this year. It almost seems as if they're trying to prime people and say, look, this is what happened in 1981 and the black community rioted then. You know, we've got Black Lives Matter now, and then there's like a gap, a pause, and the sort of logical next step is that, you know, perhaps black people who have been engaged in the Black Lives Matter demonstrations that were very sort of unruly last year will get ideas about what they can perhaps do next. And the people within the program actually said that we were the real Black Lives, we were the original Black Lives Matter, and they're referring to the riots that took place in 1981 as an uprising. And I can't really see why anybody would produce a series of podcasts like this if it wasn't to incite further riotous or protesting kind of behavior on the part of the black community this year. It just seems to be something which is a very dangerous thing to do, to be quite honest. If we go back to 1981, what happened in 1981 was that there was a Britain was in the throes of a recession as far as Brixton was concerned. In South London, there was high unemployment, and that then produced a high crime rate, and the level of particularly street crime, by this I mean muggings, in Brixton were at a much higher level than they were in surrounding areas or anywhere else in London, to be quite honest. And so Brixton was the epicenter of crime, street crime, as far as South London was concerned. The police were very concerned about the levels of crime that were taking place. It was a place where there was quite open drug taking, smoking marijuana, that kind of thing, on the streets. And you know, strangely, that's admitted almost with a sense of pride by the people that are producing this series of podcasts for the BBC now. You know, that there was drug taking, that this was all part of the Caribbean culture, that Brixton in those times in 1981 was just like a part of the Caribbean, that they're sort of they're claiming in these podcasts. And but what happened back in 1981 is that there was in January 1981, is that there was a house party in New Cross, and at this house party, a fire broke out, and 14 young black people died in that fire. They weren't able to get out of the house before the flames consumed them, and the inquiry afterwards determined that the fire had started inside the house, there really wasn't much that the police or the authorities could do about that. But there was a widespread belief amongst the black community that the fire had been started as a result of arson. And the black community decided that the police and the authorities weren't doing enough to investigate this. And so there was then a bit later on that year, I think it was in March, there was what was called a Black People's Day of Action, where a number of people who are regarded as the sort of grandfatherly figures of the black civil rights movement here in the UK took part. And on this Black People's Day of Action involved a group of several thousand people who marched 17 miles from Deptford in London all the way through to Hyde Park. And along the way, some of the people that were taking part decided to riot, and so there was, in Blackfriars, for example, there was a riot there, and the police again were concerned by the level of violence. They were concerned by the rioting that was starting to occur, and they had at the beginning of April in that year, they had already planned a campaign of stop and search that they were going to employ in the Brixton area in order to bring the crime rate down. And bear in mind that this is an area where it's street crime, which is the particularly great problem. So stop and search would appear to be the most appropriate method of reducing that. If you're stopping people who look as if they might be involved in crime, who look suspicious, and you're then searching them, and if they're carrying weapons or if they're carrying contraband that they've stolen from somebody else, then obviously you've got a good chance there of getting a conviction and deterring people from committing that sort of crime in the future. And so this campaign of stop and search took place. And during the first 5 days of this campaign, there were 943 people searched, apparently. And out of those 943 people, there were 82 arrests. And so what we can see there is that there was around about a 10% success rate. For every 10 people you stopped and searched, you found a criminal that you had sufficient evidence to arrest. That would appear to be the result of the stop and search. But what happened was that this was resented by the black community, And then a bit later on in April that year, this was on the 10th of April, there was an altercation between a group of black youths in which one of them was stabbed. And police officers stopped this young lad who was running and who got some bad wounds that he was bleeding from. And there was a little bit of confusion initially, but what eventually happened was that one or two of the police officers went with this lad into a private house where they managed to get some kitchen towel, and they were able to bind his wounds so that they could then get him to hospital. They took him out of the house, and they were in the process of putting him into the back of a police van when a crowd of black youths had surrounded the van, and they saw this young lad being bundled into the back of a police van, and they saw the fact that he was pouring with blood, he was injured, and they decided that the police were attacking him and were beating him, and so a riot then broke out, and so that was on the 10th of April, and then this rioting then continued from the 10th through to the 11th, which is the day where the worst rioting took place, and then there was rioting on a third day on the 12th, I believe, as well. And so what happened there then was that there was a situation of high crime in Brixton. The police intervened in order to try to quell the level of crime that's taking place. There was a heightened sense of suspicion and resentment on the part of the black community as a result of a number of black youths dying in a house fire. And such was the animosity between black youths and the police at that particular time that it then just blew up into the rioting that took place, which was very severe, in which I think there were something like 279 police officers injured because the rioters were throwing petrol bombs and bricks at the police, and the police had very little riot protection gear in those days. There were something like 45 members of the public were injured. There were 150 buildings were severely damaged. 30 of them were completely gutted by fire. There were something like a couple of hundred cars that were destroyed, half of them police cars, half of them civilian cars. And so it was a really terrible riot. And it just seems to me to be extremely dangerous that the BBC are producing a series of podcasts which appear to be stirring up all of the old feelings of resentment and seem to be lionizing the individuals who took part in the riots that took place then in a way that would create a grave danger that they could be priming the situation in this country for a repeat of riots of that sort. And I think that that's highly responsible of them.
So they get their gaslighting the Caribbean community, gaslighting Black Lives Matter, and saying, look what happened here in the past in the 80s. Now, I guess they would be saying that because it had a positive outcome. I'm guessing this. I mean, what was the outcome? Was the outcome that the police decided they were not going to do stop and search anymore? Or was there an inquiry that said that the police were racist? Did they get more houses out of it? Did they get more funding? And what is the reason why they are portraying this as somehow being a good thing? Do you know, Max?
I think that there was a brief stop of the use of stop and search following the riots, and that there was an inquiry, and I can't remember who it was that was involved in the inquiry. I'm not aware of anything significant in terms of legislation that followed from that. But one of the consequences of the rioting that took place in London was that the rioting then during the rest of that summer spread. And so we then had similar riots in Handsworth in Birmingham, in Southall in London as well, in Toxteth in Liverpool, in Hyson Gardens in Nottingham, in Moss Side in Manchester, and then smaller outbreaks of disorder and rioting in Leeds, Leicester, Southampton, Halifax, Bedford, Gloucester, Wolverhampton, Coventry, Bristol, and also Edinburgh, strangely. And so the occurrence of these kind of riots and this kind of disorder and the telling of the story is something which has been shown in the past to has been shown in the past to have caused the disorder to spread. And so in view of the fact that the original riots and the reporting of the original riots and the feelings of resentment that existed at the time caused the original riots to spread to all these other major towns. So I think that the publication of a series of podcasts effectively glorifying the people who took part in the riots and just trying to justify why they did what they did and trying to draw parallels between the resentment in the black community in those days with the Black Lives Matter movement of today, that's it's just a very dangerous thing. And I can't help thinking that if there are further riots later on this year, that the BBC will have gone a long way to providing the fuel that will have that will cause those riots to take place.
Yeah, they're priming the community, basically, aren't they? They're priming the black community right at the time that the Derek Chauvin trial is taking place in America. And a similar thing's happening in America. We've also recently had this black guy that was shot by a white female police officer who didn't know the difference between a taser and a gun. And then that was reported as him just being stopped for having air freshener in his window, when in actual fact he was stopped because there was a warrant out for his arrest for him carrying out an armed robbery. Then we also had a 13-year-old mestizo lad who the BBC at first reported was unarmed. He was only unarmed because he threw his pistol away, and he was also shot, and that's also being reported on at this time. So they're encouraging the black community in America to riot no matter what the outcome of this trial is. And it seems to me that the BBC are doing the same thing in Britain by producing this series of podcasts on the Brixton riots and lionising them and glorifying them and trying to draw links between that and Black Lives Matter. I mean, it really is the mainstream media and the journalists that are the biggest inciters of discord, I think, in our countries, the greatest inciters of hatred, particularly against whites, because it will all be directed against white people. And if white people aren't serving blacks, if they're not getting down on their knees in subservience to Black Lives Matter, then and obviously they're part of the problem and they're not part of the solution. That's the way that it is portrayed. The BBC just seems as very, very keen at the moment to put as many black people as they possibly can on the television and have them berate white people. So yeah, I completely agree with you there, Max. It's that is what they're doing. I mean, how else can you describe it if they're lionizing people that caused riots up and down the country with masses of destruction to houses and people as well, and then to have the very people that are actually presenting it being rappers and supportive of this sort of culture. And again, it shows us that diversity and multiculturalism is not a strength. It's the biggest weakness we've ever had. I mean, when have we ever had riots like that before? Setting fire to whole parts of cities with just wanton destruction. I mean, it's just something that is not British, and it's something that we've imported from the third world, and it's only going to get worse. And it seems that they just give in to them as well. They will allow Black Lives Matter to go out there and have their protests, and they'll have a very light touch with them, even when they're throwing push bikes at mounted police officers and throwing weapons at them and missiles at them, and they'll have this light touch. And yet, when white people go out to say, well, we want to protect our statues from this mob that are destroying them, they all end up getting prison sentences for relieving themselves and other silly things. It's double standards that we see all the way through. Another thing I've noticed with the BBC is the way that they're doing these podcasts recently. It's as if they've noticed that alternative podcasts get a lot of traction, and they're trying to copy them. You know, a similar sort of format that we have here, Max. We have two people talking or our round tables. You notice that they try to copy us, and it comes across as very, very strained. You know, their sense of humour is awful. It's so cheesy and cringy. Well, I don't know if you want to add anything else to that, or should we move into our greatest Britons?
Yeah, let's move on to our greatest Britons. Let's talk about something positive.
Yeah, let's get into David Livingstone. He's our greatest Briton for this week. We'll start with a recap. David Livingstone was one of the most popular British heroes of the late 19th century Victorian era, and his exploration of the Central African wilderness marked the final culmination of the European discovery period. His early life was hard, and we saw him working in the cotton mills from the age of 10 for 14 hours a day, while spending his Sundays getting an education before becoming a missionary and heading for Africa. His first attempt at impressing the natives by killing a lion that had been bothering them went horribly wrong when he failed to kill it with one shot, leading to permanent damage to his arm when the animal mauled it. He did succeed in converting one African, though, who went on to convert nearly his whole tribe, and we pointed out how today it is only these African churches who continue to observe traditional Christian morality. I think you pointed out, Max, that when he shot this lion, he should have had somebody else there to also fire at the lion while he was reloading. So yes, it showed that he really wasn't too well trained on these sort of things. Is there anything else that you want to pick up on in that?
Well, I think just really that we pretty well agreed last week and in the early weeks where we discussed David Livingstone, that he was somebody who goes against the normal for what is viewed as being somebody of the empire. He hadn't gone out into the British Empire in order to enrich himself or to seek glory. He'd gone out into the empire in order to help uplift the peoples that were subjects of the empire. And the fact that he was trying to spread Christianity was an aspect of that.
Oh, and he was totally against slavery as well. And he'd worked his way up to this from a very poor beginnings. You imagine he's working 14 hours a day at the age of 10, in very dangerous conditions, darting in and out of these machines that are part of the textile industry, and spending his Sundays educating himself. And he just wanted to dedicate himself to helping the lives of Africans, really. I mean, the people back here in Britain, the politicians, they really should have been dedicating themselves to helping the lives of people like David Livingstone, having to work in these textile factories and in these workhouses. But they were more concerned with stopping slavery over the other side of the world. And this is also what David Livingstone was wanting to do, because he saw some really horrific things as part of the slave trade, that particularly that were being carried out by the Arabs. And we often don't draw a distinction between these Arab slave traders and also the white slave traders, but the Arab slave traders were far more brutal than the white traders that would pick up their slaves from the blacks and from the Africans. Well, getting back to the story here, in 1851, when Livingstone left the Kolobeng mission, and that was the mission where he had converted this one African to Christianity, he did not use his failure with Seychelles to explain his departure, although it surely played an important role in his decision. Just as important had been the three journeys far to the north of Kolobeng that he had undertaken between 1849 and 1851, and which left him convinced that the best long-term chance for successfully evangelizing was to explore Africa in advance of European commercial interests and other missionaries, by mapping it and navigating its rivers, which would then become highways into the interior. Livingstone departed from the village of Linyanti, located right in the centre of the continent on the Zambezi River. He had reached this point coming from the south in Cape Town, and it was the Northern Frontier Missionary Post. He believed that if he set out from Linyanti to the northwest, up the Zambezi, this would map the best highway into the Dark Continent. He had the help of 27 native guides and warriors loaned to him by Sekulutu, the chief of the Kololo in Linyanti. They eventually reached the Portuguese city of Luanda on the Atlantic coast after profound difficulties and the near death of Livingstone from fever. He realised the route would be too difficult for future traders, so he retraced his journey back to Linyanti, and with 114 men this time, loaned by the same chief, he set off east down the Zambezi. On this leg, he became the first European to see the Smoke That Thunders waterfall, which he named Victoria Falls after Queen Victoria. Eventually, he successfully reached Quelimane on the Indian Ocean, having mapped most of the course of the Zambezi River. In this way, Livingstone became the first European to cross South Central Africa, which had never been crossed by Europeans at that latitude before, and his accomplishment made him world famous, and Livingstone was hailed as the explorer who had opened up Africa. So there's two things that we see there. We see that he has this idea that first we have to make our way into Africa and we have to open up a highway, and then we can bring Christianity to them. And he also was thinking, and then also we can open up trade to them, and trade will replace slavery, and we'll get them to start making things instead of selling each other as slaves. And secondly, we see that he had this terrible fever while he was doing this. He was very, very ill from where he had injured his arm. I mean, most of the time when he was actually in Africa, he had a fever, he had all these illnesses. If you think about the mosquitoes there and the fever that they get from that, and the Africans themselves, they're pretty much immune to it. That's why they made such good slaves in South America, because they were immune to all these fevers and diseases that you get in Africa. But as a white man, you're very susceptible to them. And this didn't stop him. He was convinced that he was going to carry on, he was going to keep going, and he was going to map this route, which had never been mapped before by anybody. And it was really this route that he mapped on his way into Central Africa that opened up the whole of Africa for everybody else to get there and start colonizing and to help to get rid of the slave trade, basically. You got any comments on that, Max?
Just also to say that during the course of this exploration of Africa, there were also great migrations taking place amongst the native African people, and so there was a migration from Western and Central Africa eastwards towards the Indian Ocean, but then also southwards, and this is the migration that took place by the Zulus and other Bantu tribes, and they were moving into territory that had previously only been occupied by the San, who are the people that are often referred to as Kalahari Bushmen, and so the San were effectively retreating in the face of the advancing Zulus and other Bantu tribes, and so Africa was a place of shifting and a place of change in those times, and the activities of people such as Livingstone and the other Great Britons that we've spoken about in the past, who have in their explorations and colonizations of parts of Africa, they were all part and parcel of that great period of turmoil and change.
I think we should also point out that even though he was against slavery and he was wanting to do his best for these Africans, he knew that there was a difference between the races. I mean, he had 100 servants here with him while he was doing this, and he needed to have their help, but it was still seen as he was the first European to do this, to map this route. And you know, you think, well, why didn't the Africans do this? Why didn't they build their own highways? They weren't capable of doing that. They needed Livingstone there to do all of this for them and to direct this for them, to try and bring them out of essentially the Stone Age, which is what they were living in. And he wanted to bring them out from that and bring them the gifts of civilization. Well, Livingstone advocated the establishment of trade and religious missions in Central Africa, but it was the abolition of the African slave trade, as carried out by the Portuguese of Tete and the Arab Swahili of Kilwa, that became his primary goal. His motto, now inscribed on his statue at Victoria Falls, was Christianity, Commerce and Civilization, a combination that he hoped would form an alternative to the slave trade and impart dignity to the Africans. He believed that the key to achieving these goals would be the navigation of the Zambezi River as a Christian commercial highway into the interior, and he returned to Britain to garner support for his ideas and to publish a book on his travels, which brought him well-deserved fame as one of the leading explorers of the age. He believed his spiritual calling was for exploration to find routes for commercial trade, which would displace the slave trade, rather than for preaching. And he was encouraged by the response in Britain to his discoveries and the support he garnered for future expeditions. So he resigned from the London Missionary Society in 1857. According to his Victorian biographer, W. Garden Blakey, the reason given was to prevent public concern about his non-missionary activities, such as the scientific work, which might have shown the LMS to be departing from the proper objects of a missionary body. In May 1857, Livingstone was appointed as Her Majesty's Consul with a roving commission, extending through Mozambique to the areas west of it, and in February 1858, his area of jurisdiction was stipulated to be the eastern coast of Africa and the independent districts in the interior. And I think this is interesting, because today they will try and say that this building up of commerce, this was taking advantage of the Africans, this was oppressing the Africans, getting them to create things, getting them to work in mines. But the whole point of it was to try and get them to do something that would replace the slave trade. We didn't want them just selling themselves as slaves and being abused by the Arabs. And the way to prevent that was to bring commerce there and to open the place up and get them to start working together. And I mean, it is unfortunate that today it has led to this massive explosion in demographics, where half of Africa now, I think, is under the age of 30. It may even be under the age of 20, which has been the unfortunate outcome of this. But the motives behind it were extremely charitable. It was trying to improve these people's lives, and he didn't want that to come in, the trade side of it, to get mixed up with the missionary side of it. So he ended up resigning from the mission. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, I agree with the points that you've made there. It is unfortunate that by taking industry and civilization and medicine in particular to parts of the third world, that that has now led to the great population increases in the world that have taken place, and that increase in world population is one of the main factors in creating conflict in the world today, and so it's strange that on the one hand we have the green and the ecology movements suggesting that we shouldn't disturb the natural balance of nature in the places that we go to with regard to animal life, and perhaps there is an argument for not disturbing the natural balance that exists between the human inhabitants of areas that that we come into contact with in the same way.
It's like the road to hell is paved with good intentions, especially if the good intentions are directed towards the outgroup instead of directed towards the in-group. The British government agreed to fund Livingstone's idea, and he returned to Africa as head of the second Zambezi expedition to examine the natural resources of southeastern Africa and to open up the Zambezi River. However, it turned out to be completely impassable to boats past the Kahura Bassa Rapids, a series of cataracts and rapids that Livingstone had failed to explore on his earlier travels. The expedition lasted 6 years, from March 1858 until the middle of 1864. Expedition members recorded that Livingstone was an inept leader, incapable of managing a large-scale project. He was also said to be secretive, self-righteous, and moody, and could not tolerate criticism, all of which severely strained the expedition, and which led to his physician John Kirk writing in 1862, "I can come to no other conclusion than that Dr. Livingstone is out of his mind and a most unsafe leader." Artist Thomas Baines was dismissed from the expedition on charges of theft, which he vigorously denied. The expedition became the first to reach Lake Malawi, and they explored it in a four-oared gig. In 1862, they returned to the coast to await the arrival of a steamboat specially designed to sail on Lake Malawi, and Mary Livingstone arrived along with the boat, having been determined to join him. But she died on the 27th of April 1862 from malaria, and Livingstone continued his explorations without her. So he may not have been that good a leader, but his determination was second to none. I mean, he would just continue with the mission that he had. He was going to achieve what he had set out to achieve, no matter what happened, even if his wife ends up dying. And we can also see there the reason why these great men from the British Empire, why they would leave their wives at home, or why they would not get married in the first place, because it was very dangerous to have a wife with you. As we see here, she just ended up catching malaria and dying. Do you want to add any comments there, Max?
And it could well be that the criticisms levelled against him with regard to his leadership ability were more a reflection of the fact that he was ill most of the time, rather than he had a natural lack of ability in that respect.
And it could also be that the people that are writing about him today are also trying to find negatives, the culture of critique. Well, the attempts to navigate the Rovuma River failed because of the continual fouling of the paddle wheels from the bodies that had been thrown into the river by the Arab Swahili slave traders. And Livingstone's assistants gradually all died or left him. It was at this point that he uttered his most famous quotation, "I am prepared to go anywhere, provided it be forward." But the British government recalled the expedition in 1863 when it was clear that Livingstone's optimism about economic and political developments in the Zambezi regions were premature. Livingstone, however, showed something of his old fire when he took his little vessel, the Lady Nyassa, with a small untrained crew and little fuel, on a hazardous voyage of 2,500 miles across the Indian Ocean and left it for sale in Bombay, now Mumbai. Furthermore, within the next three decades, the Zambezi expedition proved to be anything but a disaster. It had amassed a valuable body of scientific knowledge, and the John Kirk, Charles Miller and Richard Thornton, the scientists appointed to work under Livingstone, did contribute large collections of botanical, ecological, geological and ethnographic material to scientific institutions in the United Kingdom from the trip. The association of the Lake Nyassa regions with Livingstone's name and the prospects for colonisation that he envisaged there were important factors for the creation in 1893 of the British Central Africa Protectorate, which in 1907 became Nyasaland, and in 1966 the Republic of Malawi. So his discovery and his setting this place up actually led to an African country, the African country of Malawi. And we can see here the sort of conditions that he's in when the river itself, the paddle wheels won't work because the river is filled up with too many bodies that have been thrown into it by Arab Swahili slave traders. So what we have there is we have Arabian Negro slave traders. Basically, Swahili is a black African language. Arab is an ethnicity. So, I mean, what we're talking about there is Arabs and blacks. That's not white slave traders that have been doing this. So we'll hear a little bit more about how vile this trade actually was in a bit. Do you want to add anything to this, Max?
It's sort of evident, really, in terms of the setting the scene for the creation of Nyasaland and Malawi, that Livingstone achieved much of the same things that Cecil Rhodes did in terms of creating new countries and new administrations for parts of Africa, but did it in a rather different way.
And this happened after some years after Livingstone had died, but he was the one that really sowed the seeds for the country of Malawi. In January 1866, Livingstone returned to Africa, this time to Zanzibar, to seek out the source of the Nile. Richard Francis Burton, John Hanning Speke and Samuel Baker had identified either Lake Albert or Lake Victoria as the source, which was partially correct, as the Nile bubbles from the ground high in the mountains of Burundi, halfway between Lake Tanganyika and Lake Victoria. But there was still serious debate on the matter. Livingstone believed that the source was further south and assembled a team to find it, consisting of freed slaves, Comoros islanders, 12 sepoys and two servants from his previous expedition, Chuma and Susi. He set out from the mouth of the Rovuma River, but his assistants gradually began deserting him, with the Comoros islanders returning to Zanzibar and falsely informing the authorities that Livingstone had died. He reached Lake Malawi on the 6th of August, by which time most of his supplies had been stolen, including all his medicines. He then travelled through swamps in the direction of Lake Tanganyika, with his health declining. He sent a message to Zanzibar requesting that supplies be sent to Ujiji before heading west, before being forced by ill health to travel with passing slave traders. He arrived at Lake Muweru on the 8th of November 1867 and continued on, travelling south to become the first European to see Lake Bangweulu. Upon finding the Lualaba River, Livingstone theorised that it could have been the high part of the Nile River, but realised that it in fact flowed into the River Congo at the upper Congo Lake. The year 1869 began with Livingstone finding himself extremely ill while in the jungle, but luckily he was saved by Arab slave traders who gave him medicines and carried him to an Arab outpost. In March 1869, he arrived in Ujiji, suffering from pneumonia, only to find his supplies had been stolen. He was coming down with cholera and had tropical ulcers on his feet, so he was again forced to rely on the slave traders to get him as far as Bambara, where he was then caught by the wet season. With no supplies, Livingstone ended up having to eat his meals in a roped-off enclosure for the entertainment of the natives in return for them feeding him. I mean, the poor guy's in a really bad situation here. These people he's trying to help, they've all ripped him off, they've all stolen from him, they've run away, they've told the authorities where they ran away to that he's actually died, so there's no point in sending any more supplies, and he's now forced to rely on these slave traders to keep him alive, and he ends up eating in a roped off enclosure while the natives are laughing at him. And he's really got himself into a bad way here.
Yes, falling into the hands of his enemies, effectively, isn't he?
Yeah, and, you know, and I mean, I guess we have to give them credit as well that they looked after him. I mean, they must have seen, well, this is a white man, you have to look after him. You have to do what you can for him. This is an important person. I guess that's the way that the Arabs saw it, even though he was sort of opposed to them in wanting to do away with the slave trade. Well, next we come to a rather famous massacre. On the 15th of July, 1871, Livingstone stated in his diary that he witnessed around 400 Africans being massacred by men of the Arab ruler and slave trader Dugumbi, an associate of his, while he was visiting Niangui on the banks of the Lualaba River. The cause behind this attack is stated to be retaliation for the actions of Manila, the head slave who had sacked the villages of the Mahombo people at the instigation of the Wagenya chieftain Kimburu. He has been credited with ending the East African slave trade by reporting on this massacre of slaves in 1871. The 400 slaves that were killed were part of 1,500 that were assembled at a market, and Livingstone's diary makes it clear how much he wanted to avenge this bloodthirsty injustice. The massacre horrified Livingstone, leaving him too shattered to continue his mission to find the source of the Nile. And following the end of the wet season, he travelled 240 miles from Ngamwe back to Ujiji, an Arab settlement on the eastern shore of Lake Tanganyika, being violently ill most of the way and arriving on the 23rd of October, 1871. So we see here that the guy that actually carried out this massacre was an associate of his. It was somebody he was having to rely upon, and it was retribution for, or retaliation for, other actions that had gone on. I mean, these were very brutal people. The slaves themselves would think nothing of killing other slaves. The chiefs would think nothing of killing them. And this is why the white slave traders saw that what they were doing was actually beneficial to these Africans, to go to somewhere like America and be looked after by white slave masters was far preferable to being looked after by African chiefs or being looked after by Arab slave traders who would just massacre them in retribution. And you certainly wouldn't get that in America. They had laws that had to be obeyed, but there were no laws here. And it was this massacre and the reporting on it and saying to people, look, this is what is going on between the Arabs and the blacks in Africa, that actually inadvertently led to the banning of it, and also to Britain enforcing this ban, because the Africans really did not want to stop slavery. They didn't want to stop it at all. This is a real bugbear of mine. You know, they say Britain was responsible for slavery, yet all Africa had to do was make it illegal, and there would have been no slavery. It was Africa that was center of the slave trade, not Britain. Do you want to add any comments to this, Max?
Well, just I quite often refer to a television program that was shown, must be more than 20 years ago now, but from my recollection, it was called The Tribe, and it was a series of programs produced by a chap who was an anthropologist now, but who had been, I think he'd been a Royal Marine in his earlier life. And he used to go to indigenous peoples in remote parts of the world, and he would live with them for 6 months or so, long enough to learn all about their customs, etc. But also he made a habit of going through the manhood ceremony for each one of these tribes. And I can remember him, there was one of the programs that he had where he was living with a tribe of people in a very remote part of Central Africa. And so this is, you know, only going back to something like the late 1990s, and was talking to a chap there. And the tribe he was with had lived in a particular valley since time immemorial, and since time immemorial they had raised cattle, and the cattle that they had were the source of their wealth. But they had rival tribes that lived in the surrounding valleys, and I don't know how this question came about, but at one point anthropologist who was presenting the program asked this young chap who was representative of his tribe what the best day of his life had been. And this chap said it was the day that they got their first supply of AK-47 rifles, because they were then able to go over the pass into the next valley and massacre all of their rivals and steal all their cattle. And he sort of recounted this with a great amount of glee on his face. And I think that pretty much is in line with the kind of violence that you've just been recounting, where there is even to this very day a great amount of savagery that takes place on the continent of Africa.
It was going on back then. It was going on today. Yeah, I remember that series. A fascinating series. Yeah, I think it was just called Tribe. Well, Livingstone completely lost contact with the outside world for 6 years during this expedition. And remember that the authorities had been told that he was dead as well by his servants, unfortunately. And he was ill for most of the last 4 years of his life. Only one of his 44 letter dispatches made it to Zanzibar. One surviving letter to Horace Waller that was made available to the public in 2010 by its owner, Peter Beard, reads, "I am terribly knocked up, but this is for your eyes only. I am doubtful if I will live to see you again." Henry Morton Stanley had been sent to find him by the New York Herald newspaper in 1869, and he found Livingstone in the town of Ujiji on the shores of Lake Tanganyika on 10th of November 1871, and he greeted him with the now famous words, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." Livingstone responded, "Yes," and then, "I feel thankful that I am here to welcome you." These famous words may have been a fabrication, as Stanley later tore out the pages of this encounter in his diary. Even Livingstone's account of this encounter does not mention these words. However, the phrase appears in a New York Herald editorial dated 10th of August 1872, and the Encyclopaedia Britannica and the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography both quote it without questioning its veracity. The words are famous because of their perceived humour. Livingstone, being the only other white person for hundreds of miles, along with Stanley's clumsy attempt at appearing dignified in the bush of Africa by making a formal greeting one might expect to hear in the confines of an upper-class London club. However, readers of the Herald immediately saw through Stanley's pretensions. As noted by his biographer Tim Geale, Stanley struggled his whole life with a self-perceived weakness of being from a humble background and manufactured events to make up for this supposed deficiency. Stanley's book suggests that this greeting was truly motivated by embarrassment because he did not dare to embrace Livingstone. News of the slave massacre emerged in the world's press after Livingstone recounted the events to the journalist after this famous meeting, and Stanley's reports of the massacre changed history, prompting the British government to close the East African slave trade, which sealed Livingstone's place in history as the catalyst for abolition. Despite Stanley's urgings, Livingstone was determined not to leave Africa until his mission was complete. But his illness made him confused, and he was having judgment difficulties at this late point in his life. He explored the Lualaba and, failing to find connections to the Nile, returned to Lake Bangweulu and its swamps to explore possible rivers flowing out northwards. So you can just imagine that, can't you? Him finally meeting him. He's been looking for him all this time, and he's in such a terrible way. And he remembers his decorum and talks to him in English. It must have been like amazing for him to hear somebody speaking in English and actually seeing somebody white after all this time and being in such a state, and everybody thinking that he was dead. Do you want to comment on that? Do you know about this Henry Morton Stanley?
I don't know any more of the story really than you've already recounted. It's interesting that there was this great searching for the source of the River Nile. I think the source of the River Nile is actually Lake Victoria, and there's a place called, I think it's called Jinja, J-I-N-J-A, which is very close to Kampala in Uganda, and it's that's where the water starts to drain off from Lake Victoria and runs and is the source of the White Nile.
Yeah, that Dr. Livingstone, I presume. I think it's one of the most famous phrases that yes. There is, and this story really captured the imagination of the British. This white explorer who had been lost. Was he still alive? Was he not alive? What sort of a state was he in? And he was still on his mission. He was still trying to find the source of the Nile completely on his own, without any servants. I mean, we've talked about these expeditions that went out to the South Pole in the freezing cold, and nobody knew whether they were alive or not. And what you've got here is the other end of the situation, where it's boiling hot, it's tropical, and again, nobody knows whether they're alive or not. And only Livingstone was completely on his own. He didn't have white men around him. He didn't even have any servants around him, and he was just being treated for the amusement of the natives. And don't forget, the reason why he was there was to improve the lives of these natives, these people that had mistreated him so badly. Well, I think we should probably leave it there, Max, and we'll talk a little bit more about slavery and his discoveries next week. Have you got anything else you'd like to add before we finish?
No, I think this is a good point for us to pause.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.